Today is a historic day in the history of the San Francisco Swedenborgian Church. When considered from the quite customary way of marking history in church parishes by identifying the beginnings and endings of pastorates, we will participate presently in an honored rite in our denomination and in many denominations, the rite of installation of a pastor. We didn't bring any power tools today, Junchul. It'll be painful in a different kind of way, a sweet pain. But we will officially consecrate in our installation the Reverend Junchul Lee to formally mark the commencement of what I believe is the 10th full pastorate, covering roughly 14 decades in the history of the Second San Francisco Society of the New Jerusalem, which is the legally incorporated name of this ministry. For a spiritual reflection on this special and commemorated day, I would like to begin with a reflection on what it means to be in a historical process, first in ministry, and then to consider something of the now in that history, the open now of this moving process in time, both in this church and in each of our own lives. This is a Swedenborgian ministry that identifies as Christian, even though very much a pluralist Christian church, one that ardently, with open minds, hearts, and arms, engages other faith traditions positively in interreligious endeavor. But as a Christian church, this is a parish that's a part, therefore, of the Abrahamic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which are categorized by the scholars in the history of religions as historical religions, in the sense of being organized around a theory of history. That is, these three traditions envision a theology of history, if you will, in a way that is not the case in the same way with other major faith traditions. The Abrahamic religions understand the essence of religion as an unfolding process in history, where the divine leaves its tracks, often very decisively, and understand their religions from scriptures that speak to a story that is told about God's actions in human history. Scriptures that speak about what has been, what is now, and what shall be, as we just sang in our hymn. This is true not only of Judaism and Christianity, but also of Islam, because it too connects its sacred history from the opening of this text here, interpreting the Judaic story to unfold through the offspring of Abraham that went through Sarah, but the Muslim story starts with Abraham and the offspring that comes through Hagar. The Hebrew canon itself begins with scriptures that are two creation stories about how it all began. The 6 days of creation onto which is stitched the Garden of Eden story that provide together a mythological motif for how things got going in this cosmos, and proceeds to how God walked with God's people through what we might call a sacred historical mythos, in that unfolding tale of all the biblical narratives of those early faithful responders to God, through which are given teachings about what is important and what's essential and what is lasting, about the things we need to know regarding why we are here, where we ought to be thinking we are headed, and what we need to be doing now to be in profound accord with this God of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar et al., who walks with humanity throughout history, and thus with each and every one of us in our personal histories and our personal destinies. Now, this sacred history has become ever more complex as humanity has expanded and elongated its journey. Why, it was still a very long time ago, 500 years before Christ, when in the telling of this story, in this canon, this sacred history, there was the sacking of the temple in Jerusalem, the first Jerusalem, the old Jerusalem, and a captivity of all the people taken up to Babylon. And from that point forward, in the telling of this story, the Hebrew prophets began prophesying about a future event, something that was going to happen, about something very momentous that would involve a restoration and a transformation by another intervention of God in history through the agency of a Messiah. And of course, Christianity begins its journey with testimonies that those messianic prophecies had been fulfilled in the life and work and death of Jesus of Nazareth, that the God who oversees history for the great purposes of creation had brought about into the present tense what had been prophesied in the past about what would be. You know, but the thing is, Jesus' death did not seem like the imagined messianic victory at all, but more like a humbling defeat, a total failure, really, of all that had been expected in the messianic hope. But the Apostle Paul came along in that first generation and gave a new interpretation of divine history, saying that the final fulfillment was yet to come in a future, that God in and through Jesus had first come to overturn all the spiritual evils that had begun to govern the world, and he came to provide a new means of salvation and connection, a living, vibrant connection to the power of God. And now that that had been done in history, and that new means of salvation is now available to us in our present tense, what is left is a future full inauguration of Christ's reign that is still yet to come. That there shall be a second coming, right? There shall be a second coming of the Messiah that will be a consummation of all of the hopes of this restoration and transformation, to finish the work of this in-between time and effect a day of judgment that will create a new world order and begin a thousand-year reign. And the most complete Christian document that emerged in that first century that speaks to how this will all come about is in the book of Revelation. Everything we've been speaking today and singing today so far in our service. The book of Revelation, indeed the final book in the historical canon. And that is why I selected three brief passages from this final book for this historic day in a vast panorama of spiritual and sacred history in which we are participating, that connects us perhaps in a very real way with the spiritual endeavor that transcends time in both directions, past and future. What I have been laying out so far in the most sweeping, comprehensive scope is what is called a theology of history. It's an interpretive framework that understands time and history as a dimension of God's being. But there's an extension of spirit created in the cosmos that unfolds in time in which our lives arise, but it's only a dimension of the divine being. Swedenborg very much carried forth a framework of a theology of history in his interpretation. He taught that there are five great spiritual epochs that are viewable from our vantage point today. Two of these epochs precede all recorded time. All recorded human time are called primordial. Therefore, 40% of what Swedenborg speaks about in a gigantic theology of history is before any materials that still exist in our lives, in our world. And he believed that the current epoch, which he called the New Church, is a spiritual coming of Christ, a second spiritual coming, a spiritual atmosphere that involves an increasingly empowered spiritual relationship between humanity and God, that there's new power possible because of the psychological cleansing done in the work of Jesus of Nazareth. And the book of Revelation is, for Swedenborg, a very primary text for engaging what is going on in sacred history, including and especially now in your life and in my life. So I am talking to us about history in a really big sense on this historical day, about what it means to be in a long chain of time, connected not only with all that is, but also all that has been and all that will be, and even more with all that causes everything to be and to have presence. In this sacred now, in time, on a historic day. So Revelation is the text in the canon for which Swedenborg offered the most commentary per unit of text of all of his vast writings. I mentioned several minutes ago that the legal name of this church is the Second San Francisco Society of the New Jerusalem. And for seven decades, the name that hung on the sign outside here was Church of the New Jerusalem, which is taken from our third reading today. In Swedenborg's reading of Revelation, there are two parallel stories unfolding. One is about the spiritual history of humanity. Whereas most people today who talk about apocalypse coming and world events with big, gigantic maps saying, okay, Magog's probably now Budapest and you know, sort of tacking history and geography and using this book of Revelation as a way to prophesy what's going on. Swedenborg's distinctive in that he says most of the book is talking about the past. Most of the book is talking about a spiritual history of humanity, and only at the very end is it pointing to the current epoch and what shall be. So I selected the reading about the New Jerusalem, which is an image connected with the old longing in the messianic hope of restoring Jerusalem as a sacred city, to help us connect with the history of the founding of this church, which took its name from that verse, one that would be an interpretation and a vision of a holy city here in the midst of a worldly city, a city that would be built here and now, as well as possibly in every town, every city, every heart, every mind. I selected the letter to the church in Laodicea, which is the seventh and last of the churches addressed by the angel letters, and the one where Christ comes knocking, because I believe Christ is knocking today on this historical day on that big old wooden door that leads into this space. The seven churches stand in Swedenborg's reading for the whole spectrum of spiritual dispositions and habits and profiles, a kind of panoply of the way in which spirituality tends to get manifested among human beings. And it just so happens that Laodicea gets one of the lesser attractive portraits. They are the lukewarm church. They display inconstancy. Now, I'm not suggesting that this church is inconstant or lukewarm. But I am suggesting that every one of us can benefit from taking to heart a spiritual reflection from each angel letter. You know, my heart certainly sinks often enough when I feel lackluster. I'm personally lukewarm too much of the time. I am not always giving my best every day. Whole weeks go by. And my level of engagement isn't where it should be. Let us imagine that a majestic Christ is out there right now, knocking boldly on this door. Are we in our right frame of mind and heart to open it widely with enthusiasm and welcome God into the middle of who we are on a day-to-day basis? What would happen if we flung that door open boldly? Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens that door, I will come in. I will come in with him and I will sup with her. And to see what we might be eating and supping with Christ if we open the door to the divine that is knocking in this open now, I selected the passage in chapter 10 with the mighty angel that John sees in his vision holding a little small scroll, a little tiny scroll, in an open palm. Swedenborg says the angel's palm is open because the meaning of the word has been opened. The meaning of the word has been opened. And it's being extended with an open palm. And what is there? It's a little word. What is this little word? What was the little word for Christ when asked to give the digest of the entire law of what was most essential? What was the word in its little version? To love God wholly and care about our neighbor every bit as much as we care about ourselves. That's it. End of passage. That's the little scroll, and the angel tells John to eat it. And he predicts to him that it'll be a little tough to digest, but you know, the taste at last will become sweet. Yes, indeed, how challenging is the curriculum of love. How hard it is to break out of our egoisms and care about others as much as we care about ourselves. But most of us know from experience enough that there is something about life becoming sweeter when we do it. When we taste that bitter myrrh of discipline and obedience. Eating the little scroll symbolism is the same thing as eating communion that is done. The eating of the bread of life, the masticating it and chewing it and digesting it so that it then becomes constitutive with our whole being, physically and also with our living spirit. and for all his astoundingly ambitious reflections on the biggest questions of heaven and earth, and for all his startling revelations about the unfolding cosmos, about the nature of the divine life, about our life after death, and the unending wealth of wisdom as he unleashes spiritual insight page after page across the whole biblical narrative, Swedenborg teaches actually nothing esoteric. There's no secret handshakes anywhere in the Swedenborgian canon. No mystery rites. Chop wood, carry water, love your neighbor, love God, eat little scrolls. The church is the church when we are all helping each other learn the curriculum of love, helping each other to be our best selves and how we can give ourselves away to others, to society, to God, forever. And this church, this little, somewhat humble church at Lyon and Washington in San Francisco, has a pretty special history. The way in which this story here has helped folk, many dozens of thousands, have come here and helped people from many generations make some headway and some heartway in the questions of why we are here and what it is we should be about. And now it is time to start a new chapter in history marked in time by the beginning of the pastorate of Reverend Junchul Lee. Because I tell you, the God of all history is knocking at the door of the Second San Francisco Society of the New Jerusalem and at the heart of each one of us, offering to come in and sup with us. And let no one ask, what's for lunch?